welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our exploration of the cultures of consciousness. Last week, we had a great conversation with Matt Carden, a horror writer and scholar of the supernatural and its relationship with religion. And we talked a lot about the kind of hidden secret connections between religion, religious thinking, and the genre of horror in particular. And this week, we're going to sort of carry on a similar theme with returning guest Victoria Nelson. We had Vicky on the show a couple of years ago. She wrote a great book a number of years ago called Secret Life of Puppets that looked at the mercurial and hidden ways that lingering esoteric and mystical themes continue to exist in our modern popular culture. And she's continued her research with a new book called Gothica, which looks at gothic fiction or the genre, the whole world in the broadest possible sense. Vampires, ghosts, the supernatural, demons, taking it forward into zombies and even Christian romances. A wonderful look at another way to look at popular culture, because that's part of what this way of reading culture, and particularly genre fiction, is about, is that you can bring the same sensibility, the same sense of historical and even spiritual continuity to the way you look at big-budget Hollywood films as the way you look at actual sacred sites or religious texts or groups that, you know, worship God in certain ways or in other ways. And it's a, you know, bit of a mishmash, a mashup of perspectives, but it also tends to reveal a great deal, not only about the hidden spiritual and religious promptings behind popular culture, but also the ways in which fiction and the imagination, of course, play themselves out in a religious register. And if we're trying to track the cultures of consciousness, it's a great place to see the way that the impulses of the mind to reach beyond the quotidian, to reach towards something like the supernatural, that kind of grab, that kind of move, as much manifests itself in our popular culture as it does in explicit spiritual or paranormal practice. So it's a big theme we've been exploring here off and on in many ways on Expanding Mind, and I look forward to talking with Vicky more about it. But first, we'll bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Dao. Hi, Maja.
Hi, Eric. How's it going?
Pretty good. So do you like, what do you like better, vampires or zombies?
Definitely vampires. You know, it's funny, when you were talking, both of those two, they're kind of like the Rolling Stones of, like, archaic pop culture. Because if you can look at, like, vampires, for example, like how much those influence popular culture over how many hundreds of years? Like, that's insane. That's like if David Bowie will still be influencing pop culture in, like, 2,000 years or something, right? Like,
oh, it's
any
amazing
kind of archetype can affect popular trends like the vampire so consistently. It's really ridiculous.
Yeah, well, so I'm trying to figure out, I don't know if I'm going to come up with it, but like if the vampires are the Rolling Stones, you know, stretching all the way back to the 1960s, what the zombies are some kind of punk rock?
Yeah, they're totally
because
punk
they're
rock.
Much newer. You know, it's like there's, I mean, you know, there's a few mentions of zombies in the 19th century. You get a little bit of a sense of it, but it really doesn't start rolling in the modern sense until really after World War II, which is one of the things that Vicky talks about in her book. There's a great chapter on the zombie and the different way, you know, how the vampire's kind of romantic, and there's a sort of supernatural aura of a kind of, you know, almost a religious sort of heretical mystique around them, but the zombies are very secular creatures in a lot of ways. So
yeah.
I'm trying to figure out what the what the analogy is, but I
that was pretty
I can't
good. I think
there.
You nailed it with the punk rock.
So well, with that on, let's bring Vicki onto the show. Thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Hey, Eric, how are you?
Very good, very good. So I've spent the last couple of days devouring Gothica, and it's really such a fun read. It's such a treat to read, you know, incisive thinking about, you know, crazy pop culture, and to read it in such a fun prose style. It's really engaging. It's sort of like reading one of the novels, you know, just directly, because it's so rich. But even more than that is that you just do a lot of legwork. I mean, I'm not going to read the Left Behind series. I'm not going to read Twilight. I'm not even going to see the movies. And now I can say, you know, I have my finger on the pulse. I get the new Uncanny. I'm there. So I really appreciate your hard work.
Well, thank you. And I just want to add to your discussion that if the vampires are the Rolling Stones, then the zombies have got to be the Beatles. What can I say?
So, you know, there's so many places. I was trying to think of the different ways into this book, but here was the question that popped in my head, is that one of, you know, as I said, one of the strong cases you're making is that we need to look at this material both in the origins of the Gothic in the you know 18th century and in terms of today's incredible flowering of Gothic subgenres across the world, that we need to look at that at least in part through the eyes of religion and alternative spirituality. And but the question I want to start up was for you personally, can you say the ways that this genre or this kind of material has in your life sort of woven those two strands together that you can see when you look back at your own attraction to vampire novels or horror films or whatever was really, you know, whatever got you onto this train so many years ago, because you've been writing and reading about this stuff for so long, did that for you have something to do with this own, with your own kind of quest to understand or explore the dimension of spirit or your own religious identity?
Well, yes, Eric, absolutely. I think that's right. I had from a very early age an immediate attraction to ghost stories, and I always loved and continue to love the great 19th and early 20th century ghost story writers like the great Montagu, Rhodes, James in England, Algernon Blackwood, Arthur Machen, all these classic early writers of the Victorian and Edwardian ghost stories. I just had a natural attraction to the supernatural. And when I finally came to write The Secret Life of Puppets, the question I had in my mind always was, why is the supernatural depicted in our culture as a sort of evil, you know, demonic, scary thing when you think about, for instance, Hindu religion or even the Catholic, you know, pantheon of saints and Mary and so on. And the answer I arrived at was really that it's a very particular circumstance of the Protestant Reformation and the sort of sequestering of the supernatural into the realm of Satan as a dark, bad force. And the Gothic genre was really very much an outgrowth of this, as well as a kind of a guilty attraction to all things supernatural.
Well, I want to stop here just because this is such an important point. It's such an illuminating and helpful argument, you know, and Protestantism is just such a weird phenomenon. Studying the history of religion, studying the history of the West, it's It has many unusual characteristics that make it different than a lot of other religious traditions. And there's a lot of ways to talk about it. Probably one of the simplest is that, you know, a lot of people talk about our secular world, you know, our post-religious world of capitalism and science and common sense and reason, that mind frame itself is an evolution of Protestantism. It's not a reaction to it. It's not a break. That actually there's something weird about the way that Protestantism itself disenchants the world. And if I understand your argument, you're saying that Protestantism comes along, it steadily disenchants the world so that and by doing so all the good fairies go away.
That's
all
right.
The saints go away.
Right.
And all you have left is all the lingering fear and despair and terror before death, before the guilt we bring before God, all these sort of negative emotions that are adhered to so much of the Protestant sensibility, and that's the realm of Satan, that's the realm of the ghost, that's the thing that still can't quite be banished with this mode of disenchantment, and then it lives on as the Gothic and as the supernatural.
Yes, I think that's exactly true up to about the year 1999 when all sorts of strange things started to happen. But I just would say, yes, it was the Protestant Reformation in conjunction with the scientific revolution in Western culture that brought about this change, so that there was an immediate disassociation of our daily world with what used to be, you know, the possibility of miraculous intervention. Now, that's a whole complicated subject that has its own positives and negatives, you know. You think about Pat Robertson saying that the people of Haiti deserve their earthquake because, you know, of, you know, lapses in their morality or whatever, and that's an extreme version of the old view. So the old view was not without its extreme drawbacks. On the other hand, there is the Protestantism, I think, is unique in having this sharp division between the three bright male gods of light, that is God, Jesus, and the Holy Ghost, and everything else. But the old kind of supernaturalism kind of got banished both from a official religion and also mainstream intellectual culture, and was left to sort of stew in its own juices in popular culture. And I think one of my favorite little epigrams is something the late poet Paul Bray said that I quoted in The Secret Life of Puppets, and that is that the American occult is the intellectual life of the common people. And so all of these weird beliefs that actually did come over to this country during the Radical Reformation, there were many radical Protestant sects that kept the old beliefs going in one way or another, that fed into all of the various great awakenings in this country over the last couple of centuries, and also informs the supernatural as it plays out in popular culture.
Absolutely.
I mean, in films and stories and so on.
You know, even just thinking back to the 19th century greats like Nathaniel Hawthorne and of course Edgar Allan Poe, both of whom of course totally readable today. I mean, it's amazing the power of this genre resonance, where you really don't have to lean very far to be able to go back, you know, 150 years to a different kind of era of the English language and be able to really enjoy yourself with some of that stuff, because in a way it's such a familiar current. And it, you know, for me it reminded me also just like more personally how that horror and the supernatural and, you know, but particularly the spooky stuff, you know, the Lovecraft and the more supernatural horror genre, which is probably my favorite of all these flavors, you know, it is a very, it can produce a very sort of religious experience in the sense that, as we were talking about last week with Matt, that there's a, you know, fundamental aspect of how at least modern people have come to understand religious experience is that it has something in it of dread and fear as well as of awe and sublimity. And so it really, I think, is a way that people can even emotionally touch feelings that otherwise are often very difficult to access that aren't just getting your little, you know, your spooky goosebumps and having an excuse to hug your date. You know,
right.
There's something more in the affect, the emotions that's around this stuff.
Yes, and you know, the Gothic genre itself is interesting because as it started, as most people will say, with Horace Walpole's Castle of Otranto back in 1764, it was also the same time that there was this reaction against classicism, and Edmund Burke put forth his idea of the sublime, and the sublime is actually, in his conception of it, an experience of terror, you know, of overwhelming awe, in the sense of awe that sort of later became degraded into the word awful. But the Gothic itself had a couple of different strands. One of them was supernatural. The other one was what is called the explained supernatural. That is, you get all the titillations of a possible ghost or force or whatever, and then it turns out later that there's some rather implausible rational explanation for it. But the nostalgia for a world in which the supernatural took active participation was really one of the driving forces that started the Gothic genre. And that force carried it right through. And I like to note as a sort of irony that the Gothic was kind of the very disreputable, lowbrow sibling of the Romantic movement that produced many great poets and writers. But at this moment of time that we're speaking in, the Romantic movement is dead as a doornail, and the Gothic has kept on chugging away for 250-plus years.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because that is actually literally true in one of my favorite examples of Mary and Percy Shelley, right? You see the Romantic and the Gothic married to each other literally, and I kind of felt like that was such a good example of what you're saying, where they were born from each other in a very like specific fashion, I think, with those two especially. But and it's funny because I do think that romanticism kind of died and some of the Gothic took over in its place, kind of like, you know, as a result of what Eric was saying with the zombie movement a little bit, where, like, vampires do have that romantic element, but it went more macabre the more society kind of was engaging in some of those things. I mean, what do you think about that, the way romanticism died as a following of some of the war culture and stuff like that?
Well, I think zombies are an interesting phenomenon, and both zombies and vampires originally were regarded in Western Europe as very exoticized entities coming from an outside sort of wilderness place. Vampires, I talk about this in the book, actually from the southern Slavic regions in Greece rather than Eastern Europe, but then very quickly they became identified with Eastern Europe, and there's a whole literature around the fact that Dracula is, among other things, a product of the extensive immigration into England of Eastern Europeans in the late 19th century, and so you get this horrible creature coming and preying on all these good English people. And zombies, by the same token, come out of Caribbean African culture. Zombie originally was a word that meant god in West Africa, and then became in the Caribbean a kind of automaton, dead person who was under the control of a sorcerer. And I talk in the book about how gradually zombies got transferred into mainstream American culture, first as these exoticized creatures, and then the resemblance of zombies to mindless mobs, and most particularly soldiers, came out right after World War II, and you had all these comic books about Nazi zombies and so on, which I just would add as a tiny footnote. There's a great new Norwegian movie called Dead Snow about Nazi soldier zombies who get revivified in the mountains of Norway today, and it's so clearly a metaphor of the lack of resolution about the German Nazi occupation of Norway during World War II. So yes, there is this association of zombies with soldiers. The interesting thing to me is now, in the last decade, this 21st century, zombies have really been vying with vampires for kind of primacy, and there are even these sort of crossbreed. I mean, the essence of Gothic is hybridity, right? So now there are these crosses between zombies and vampires that I like to call zampires. That yeah, you see this in Justin Cronin's The Passage, where his vampire creatures really are kind of a species of zombie. You know, I once asked this class of mine at UC Berkeley, I was giving a class on the Gothic, and I said to the class, well, why is it, you know, what's the appeal of zombies now over vampires? And this one charming person responded that all students at Berkeley were like, you know, fast lane overachievers who, you know, got straight A's and volunteered for community service and held part-time jobs and so on and so on. And she said that the idea of being a zombie was actually kind of relaxing.
Well, it's also interesting, though, and this gets around to the religious theme again, and I'd like to, you know, maybe pull this question out a little bit because it remained a little unclear for me in Gothica. Is that, you know, another distinction is that just in terms of how the more modern zombie, or, you know, since Romero's film has developed, is there something profoundly secular about the zombie. It's very much a whatever the cause, and even though it's undead, it's not because of some, you know, ancient romantic pre-modern current of some kind of supernatural spirit that can be fought with crucifixes and holy water. Mm-hmm. It's some, you know, it's a, you know, nuclear thing or a released virus or just some kind of disease. It's very much about the meat. And one of the things that's driving the zombie today, I think, is because it's a supernatural that can be readily affirmed by really secular people. For example, in the academy, people love zombies. There are so much zombie studies. Now, the actual popularity of the zombie as a figure in popular culture has not, like, completely, you know, blown vampires out of the water by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah. But the academic discourse around vampires, though it's there, has none of the, like, hip, groovy, edge-walking quality of the zombie discourse, and I think it's partly because the zombie can serve as a purely modern biopower hunk of flesh in a way that allows people to avoid some of the religious implications of the supernatural.
Yeah, I think you're quite right about that, Eric, that the Academy is much more comfortable with the zombie for that reason, because, you know, both of these creatures have very strong metaphorical resonances, and the secular high culture mainstream is always going to be more comfortable talking about these things as metaphors, whether, you know, with zombies it's a metaphor of AIDS or the outsider or, you know, the political parasite, which was actually Voltaire that was using the word vampire as a metaphor way back in the 18th century. So always metaphor is how the supernatural is most readily approached in Western high culture. But I do think one thing about zombies, which I guess I tried to address a bit indirectly, is it is very much a pre-modern, in-your-face look at death, physical death, and the gruesomeness and, you know, physicality of rotting flesh, which was something that was a great, great theme in the 15th century with in Europe with the plague and so on, and how the first representations of the dance of death and death as an actual character who would dance people away high and low no matter what their degree. And what I did try to do in the book was to show that the reification of death since about the 1980s in all kinds of ways, and most, I think, strikingly in the form of these roadside memorials, which are completely Catholic to my way of thinking, and started sprouting up, you know, if somebody, you know, had a car wreck in a certain place, and so the family would leave all these memorabilia and so on. You just never, ever saw this until about that time. And so I think, in a funny way, the reality of death is another way of engaging with what in our culture was an older worldview. With zombies now, what's happening is a very, very interesting trend, and that is the zombies are on the same trajectory as the vampires. You wouldn't think that having sex with a zombie was ever going to be in the books, but boy, it's happening, and the zombies are turning into kind of quasi vampires in the sense that they're starting to breed with humans. They're starting to reverse their process.
This gets us into one of the ideas I really want to clarify that we'd set up before about how the Gothic was this dark, unremittingly dark thing till throughout the 20th century, but that just in the last 15, 20 years, there's been a really remarkable change across these genres that's like the freshest message I got from your book. So talk about what that change is. I mean, what's happening with this stuff?
Well, the change is really, I think, it's a very natural one in the sense that since the only kind of way you can address the supernatural in our culture outside of organized religion, which is kept very ghettoized from mainstream culture, even though all people, and especially people seeking public office, have to pay enormous obeisance to it. But to just explore spirituality and religion, the only place you really have to do it is in the fictions and imaginative discourses that you find in popular culture, which is one of the reasons why many of these works that I talk about, from Lovecraft to Tolkien to Star Trek and so on, have actually seen little religions, little spiritual groups grow up around them. So, you know, especially with Lovecraft, it's you know, it's not a pleasant religion exactly, and I do think there is a natural, instinctive human urge for brightness to be balanced, you know, darkness to be balanced with brightness. That you can't, you know, you can't just be a Black Sabbath type person. You have to. If you have any kind of spiritual instinct, whatever, you need to also be going for the light. So you've got this genre that's full of dark supernatural things. I think the natural trajectory is for the dark characters to start lightening up, and that really is exactly what happened in the vampire genre, in the whole graphic novel Son of Satan trajectory. You see all of these characters starting to transform, the first basic transformation being, of course, moving from being the villain to the hero. And as I mentioned in the book, then that really started with the vampire subgenre, with Anne Rice's Interview with the Vampire, where you get this vampire who's telling his own story to an interviewer in the first person. He's still kind of dreadful, but the very fact that it's in the first person makes you identify with him. And another thing that Rice did was she moved vampires out of the category of undead into immortal, which is, you know, an immediate step up, clearly, and a start in the trajectory towards divine. And she, you know, she goes on with that to make vampires the descendants of, you know, the Egyptian gods Isis and Osiris. So she was putting a few things in place there that then got picked up and developed over the next 30 years until you get to someone like Stephanie Meyer, whose vampires are really exemplary creatures. They're ethical vampires. They don't feed on people. They live in a beautiful McMansion that's the total reverse of Dracula's kind of grotty old castle. They do good deeds. They're okay, you know. Once in a while they have to nip out to a national park and feed on a few unfortunate small mammals they come across to, you know, slake their desire for blood, but they're quite remarkable. And in the course of those four novels, she really, when her human heroine, Bella, decides that she has to become a vampire if she's ever going to be on a par with Edward, her vampire lover, you see her path into immortality, becoming one of a, really becoming kind of an amazing perfected being. She has amazing superpowers. She's really quite godlike. She has total recall. She has an infallible memory. She's as beautiful as a goddess. And in effect, she really is a kind of goddess. So I think in Twilight particularly, you see this movement into the light. But it's really just trying to broaden the vocabulary of the supernatural to include the whole other side of things. With zombies, interestingly, you do see the same thing happening, and there are the new zombie novels like Isaac Marion's Warm Bodies. has a zombie main character who falls in love with a human girl, restrains his impulses to feed on her brains, just like Edward.
That's important.
In Twilight, and ultimately, when he and his human kiss, they've been afraid to do this because he's afraid it will trigger his instincts. Just like Edward could never have sex with Bella because he was afraid it would trigger his instincts. Something happens to both of them, and they both gain superhuman, supernatural powers. They both become more than human and more than zombie at the same time. And I don't know if the sequel is out yet, but this to me is very much the path that these characters are following, that they are humans who get turned into supernatural creatures for some reason that's usually beyond their control, dark supernatural creatures, and then they go through a second transformation in which they become essentially divine humans, which
This is just totally fascinating stuff, especially when you think about all the kind of religious and spiritual implications that are going on in the genre, you know, on a broader level. So I look forward to continuing this. Right now we have to take a break. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Dawu. We're talking with Victoria Nelson about her new book, Gothica, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Dawu. We're here with Eric Davis, and we're speaking with Victoria Nelson about Gothica and vampires and zombies and all that fun stuff. Victoria, it's so fascinating what you're saying about that beautification of these dead, you know, archetypes into immortals. And to me, that really kind of speaks to the point that Eric was making about how the Gothic appeals to the intellectual as opposed to some of the Protestant movements, because the Protestants, and especially the born-again Christians and all those left-behind folks, they have to have death be terrible because they use death as a punishment. Right? So for them, death has to be this horrible zombified thing, because if it's not, and you don't, like, you know, love Jesus before you die, that's it. You're screwed. So they almost, like, have to have it be some kind of demonized, horrible, terrible thing. So what's fascinating to watch is as death gets more integrated, as people went through, like, a lot of that, you know, dealing with the zombie and getting that put in your face, that people are, like, you know, getting, to me, the beautification of the vampire and the zombie means maybe we're getting, like, a little less afraid of death and not having to have it be this, like, eternal punishment factor in determining our beliefs. Because there was, I remember so clearly, there was this conversation that I had with a born-again Christian, and he was berating me for reading about so many different types of religions and things. And he said, how do you know what to believe? So to a lot of that mindset, the intellectual aspect of Gothic material is a threat to their belief system, to the fact that dying, you know, what if it's great to be an immortal vampire who drinks blood forever and you're actually beautiful and awesome? Well, they see that as, like, no good for Jesus, right? So it's interesting, like what Eric said, to look at the religious implications of what you're saying is happening. And I was wondering, like, have you seen or researched any, like, religious implications that have happened to some of the maybe born-agains as a result of Twilight, like some of their reactions? Have you heard anything about that?
Not directly, Maja, but I would say that Protestant hell is still very big in the Gothic. At the same time, you know, conservative Christians have always reacted against, for instance, the amazing rise of Halloween in popular culture by having their own, they have like harvest festivals and so on as a kind of
which is hilarious because those are pagan.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I really have a lot of sympathy for that side of the fence, and I think it's often our side of the fence tends to look at them in caricatured forms, but I come from a family that was for many, many generations Southern Baptist. I have a lot of cousins and relatives who are still devout practitioners, and I completely respect the dedication they have to their spiritual life. I think that all people on either side of the fence are attracted to this new material, and I do talk about William P. Young's The Shack, which is a Christian Gothic novel, which is so different in sensibility from the Left Behind series, which I think really was a sort of late 20th century into the 21st century militaristic vision that, you know, the Iraq War, unfortunately, kind of valorized. But The Shack is a different animal altogether, and all of my relatives have avidly read it, my Southern Baptist relatives, and they even sponsored William P. Young in their church up in Yuba City, which I went to see, and he has been roundly condemned by other conservative Christians as being heretical on all kinds of counts, but he presents a very beautiful vision of spirituality that is kind of framed inside a Gothic story. So I'm just saying that it's not it's a very complicated picture, and what I see really is a trend that out of all of the kind of spiritual imagining that the Gothic and other pop culture genres promote will come some kind of very interesting new religion. Now, having made that prediction in Gothica, I really got myself kicked around by a lot of people.
Actually, talk a little bit about that, because when I came to that part of your book, I was like, whoa, there's a bold move. And I'm like, you know, I think it's good to make bold moves in things. They stir stuff up. But what does that stirring look like?
Okay, well, first of all, I think that people coming to the book outside of religious studies, and that includes Gothic scholars and I would say some of the other reviewers of my book, don't really understand what a world religion is. A world religion is really a religion that has international presence, so that you see now in all the basic religion textbooks, Scientology is featured as a world religion. We in this country saw the beginnings of two world religions in the 19th century, and that is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, and also Christian Science. Both of those religions drew from this strange streak of maverick radical Reformation almost heretics, you'd have to say, who came over to this country in the 17th century, and both of those religions in their own ways present this notion of the human who is able to become divine. In Mormon theology, it's after death. In Christian Science, it's really more direct. This particular strand is what I see feeding into so many of these works of fiction, Gothic works of fiction, that I've been looking at. And so, given the fact that so many fan groups now turn to these works of the imagination and literally use them as scripture. And I grant you, it's not a lot of people, but it's definitely something going on. I just think it's more than likely that something will come out of that, something new and very interesting. Beyond that, I just don't have any idea what it's going to look like, but let's revisit this question in 30 years and see if I'm right or not.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to think also how much it, you know, it resembles the kind of such an open-ended, like a world of possible recombinations, like genre itself. I mean, one of the things you're looking at is like how genres, they hybridize, they interweave. The vampire gets mated with the zombie, and some new thing happens, and there's a constant sort of transformation. And that's in a way what people are looking for. They want to be both familiar. I know this world. I know what a vampire story or a ghost story looks like. But there has to be something kind of new and slightly different about it. And what we might be looking at is something that has that kind of characteristic too. And in fact, something that we already kind of see. I mean, there's a whole other side of things that you didn't talk about so much in terms of new religious movements, where you know people are looking at these sort of make believe religions. What if religions? You know, like the Jedi's or the spaghetti monster stuff, or these kinds of ironic, parodic religions that nonetheless end up taking on a little bit more seriousness than maybe they intend. Or the Church of the Subgenius is another example. But again, these are tiny little places in the culture, but they suggest there might be something where the very question is this just a fiction, or is this my belief about the structure of reality, that those two perspectives kind of maybe break down a little bit, and we just get used to experiencing different worlds. So we're participating in a virtual world and an online gaming world that has religious overtones in some kind of belief system that we can use as a way to play with people we know online, and then like in our other life we're a doctor or some kind of, you know, secular mm-hmm. kind of position, and it just becomes very confusing to even say what's religion, what's not a religion, what do people actually believe, and I think that that's part of the world you're opening up to as well in the book.
Yeah, that's really an interesting comment, Eric. I think my take on the what if the sort of parody religions is that's a very postmodern kind of sensibility at work there. And for my money, postmodernism died with the 20th century. It's over, you know, and the irony and the parody is a part of that. And what this century, I think, is going to be all about, for better or for worse, is spirituality, you know, the kind of return of what I talked about in The Secret Life of Puppets as being the gnosis way of knowledge, in contrast to episteme, the sort of rational ways of accessing information. And my gut feeling has always been that culture thrives when both of those have been given equal weight. And for the last 300 years, we have been really in the grip of episteme. Before that, I mean, to make a totally sweeping generalization, before that gnosis, you don't want it all one way because, you know, back in the gnosis times of the, you know, Middle Ages into Renaissance, you know, you could get burned at the stake for putting forward the other way of knowing. During the episteme era that we live in, you just get laughed at and ridiculed. You know, it's not the consequences are not that terrible. But I think when a culture can equally acknowledge both ways of knowing, it stands the best chance of being a really rich and powerful era. And I feel I'm happy about the rise of spirituality in popular culture and in other ways. Of course, there are the dark sides to it, as there always are, but I think there's more of a chance of enrichment, total enrichment of knowledge, to have the two equally acknowledged.
Well, and I think that that really is the key, because that will be what prevents people from viewing the outside thing as the threat, right, and then reacting against
it.
As long as these institutions, instead of getting to know about what's going on, you know, maybe reading the Twilight books, I don't know, they could, like, see what they're talking about, then they'll actually, it'll be based out of not ignorance, but like you said, gnosis, when they'll actually intelligently consider all the different views and then incorporate them instead of trying to separate and punish the ones that are not like them.
Well, yeah, because there's what we are totally unconscious of is that there's materialist fundamentalism as well as religious fundamentalism,
right.
You know, and we don't often, we don't recognize our own unconscious biases towards things religious and spiritual.
Yeah, and I think that whole question of the dynamic between the gnosis side and the episteme side, in a way, that's kind of what you're pointing to in the point you made earlier, and that you make strongly at the end of your book about the sort of two transformations that these characters go through. They're ordinary humans. Then they open up to some supernatural side that has an evil aspect, that is an instinctive aspect, a murderous aspect. But then there's this second transformation that makes them sort of integrate that, but also sort of restrain it in kind of a higher human way. So they become creatures that are neither, that are both human and supernatural. And you talk about this apotheosis or self-divinization, and the Bella character in Twilight is the great example of someone who goes from this purely human state, not even a monster state, into this kind of divine figure. And what I think we have there is in a way a sort of mythology of human possibility, a human possibility that must go through the supernatural, that must run the risk of the gothic, of possibility that's irrational or spooky or weird, but that really ultimately leads to something that's in a way more recognizable as human. It's not just some completely bizarre other world, but sort of a potential that we have inside. I mean, I guess that's just kind of the message of that religion of gnosis that you also talk about in the book as a kind of core American current of religion that doesn't even necessarily take religious forms.
Yeah, in some ways, you know, the whole ethical vampire thing is a funny reworking of the notion of original sin, you know, that you're born with all these bad instincts and it's your duty as a human to, you know, to master them in some form or another. I just would say, though, that the 900-pound gorilla is still the supernatural part of it. That the end result is a human who has superhuman powers, and of course we can recognize this in, you know, the comic books, the, you know, Superman and all the other superheroes after him who don't have necessarily an extraterrestrial origin, but have something awful happen to them, and they turn into these creatures. But nine times out of ten, they are creatures working for the good, in spite of the fact that their supernatural power has made them kind of an outcast or even a deformed, you know, as a kind of deformity in terms of normal human society.
Well, great. Well, you know, I think we're going to wrap things up about here. Victoria, thanks so much for being on Expanding Mind.
It was a total trip, Eric and Maja. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, and again, Victoria's new book, Gothica, Vampire Heroes, Human Gods, and the New Supernatural. So from all of us here, Expanding Mind, PRN, keep your minds open.